Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 111. It's Monday, April 26th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's start up with a follow-up from last week when I talked about the weird risk assessment of the J&J vaccine being paused and how these extremely rare cases don't match up with the benefit from continuing the vaccinations. So this from the Hill: CDC panel recommends resuming Johnson & Johnson vaccinations. The nationwide pause on the use of Johnson & Johnson's coronavirus vaccine should be lifted, a Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Vaccine Advisory Committee recommended last Friday. A risk-benefit analysis presented by CDC staff found if the vaccines resume in all adults over 18, about 26 cases of clotting could occur out of a projected 9.8 million doses administered over the course of 6 months. Over the same period, about 2,200 deaths and 1,400 ICU admissions would be prevented if the vaccine were resumed for use in all adults. Okay, there you get it from the expert committee. Which is basically consistent with what I was saying last episode, is that we're comparing 26 cases of clotting, which of course does not necessarily result in hospitalization or death, but might result in a few deaths. That's compared with not vaccinating, not having it accessible, on the order of 2,200 deaths and 1,400 ICU admissions. Doesn't seem like much of a choice to me. And of course, we don't live in a perfectly rational world, so the risk assessments we make are not necessarily proportional to one another. I think this is a very thought-provoking one, this from Stat News. For people of color, where is our pause from being killed by police? Like many health professionals, I spent a lot of time over the course of the pandemic thinking about how to communicate public health risk. For months, I've been counseling people over the risk of such things as going to the gym, the grocery store, or traveling. I talked about when to wear a mask, what kind of mask to wear, and the risk of aerosols. I've also talked about how safe the vaccines are in comparison to how dangerous COVID-19 is. Recent news of the pause of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has renewed my conversations about risk. I've reassured people that the risk of the vaccine causing blood clots is very low, and the benefits of its protection from severe COVID-19 is massive. Even so, the Food and Drug Administration paused vaccination efforts while it and the CDC collected more data. The message is that safety must be a priority. The country just paused an entire vaccine rollout because of a complication with the risk of 1 in a million. For black men, the lifetime risk of being killed by police is 1 in 1,000. For Latino men, it's 1 in 1,800. Where is our pause? A very good question. Of course, the FDA does not regulate the police. And apparently there's no other agency that can regulate the police as well as the FDA regulates drugs. Okay, well, there's still a lot of COVID-19 public health news, but we're going to get to some other non-COVID news later on. We're going to do some environmental stories in honor of Earth Day from last weekend. But let's start with this from Stat News. States with springtime COVID-19 surges appear to have turned a corner. Michigan and other states that experienced springtime COVID-19 surges or faced worrisome transmission trends appear to have turned a corner, with drops in new cases in recent days as vaccines reach more people. After hovering at stubbornly high levels or increasing over the past 2 months, average daily cases in Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, Illinois, and other states in the Midwest and Northeast have started to fall, providing a breath of relief that the communities are past their most recent peaks. Crucially, new infections in Michigan, which experienced the worst of the spring spikes, with some of its highest COVID-19 levels of the entire pandemic occurring in recent weeks, have started declining, with hospitalizations also starting to tick down. Experts are cautious that the progress has just begun and needs to be sustained if the states want to actually achieve low levels of transmission, but they're heartened that it appears vaccines are increasingly not just protecting individuals from COVID-19, but are starting to have broader benefits for communities. At the national level, the country's average daily infection count has also started to come down, from more than 70,000 in the middle of April to closer to 60,000 now. By summarizing the U.S. COVID-19 epidemic from that frame obscures how much variability there is. After experiencing a horrific surge over the winter, California now has one of the lowest rates of infections in the country, while cases in Puerto Rico have increased over the past month. We remain in a complicated stage, Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, said at a briefing. On the one hand, more people in the United States are being vaccinated every single day at an accelerated pace. On the other hand, cases and hospitalizations are increasing in some areas of the country, and cases among young people who have not yet been vaccinated are also increasing. The progress in the United States stands in stark contrast to most of the rest of the world, which lacks anything close to the vaccine supply this country has. Persistently high cases in Europe and the Americas, and huge spikes in Asia, have driven global case counts to among the highest levels of the whole pandemic. Trends can also be moving in the right direction when, in raw numbers, infections are still high. Cases may be coming down in Michigan, but they're still higher than they were at just about any other point in the pandemic. National case counts in the 60,000 range, as opposed to the, say, 20,000 range, mean that many more people will suffer severe outcomes from the coronavirus. And while death counts have dropped dramatically from the more than 3,000 people taken daily in the United States in stretches of January and February, the progress has been stalled at more than 700 deaths per day. The hope is that if case counts continue to fall over the coming weeks, deaths will follow in turn. Already, the rollout of vaccines has dramatically changed the dynamics of the U.S. epidemic. Hospitalization and death rates among older adults, the population with the highest immunization coverage, have plummeted, while hospitalizations among younger adults have also started to come down more recently. Whereas for the first year of the pandemic, hospitalizations and deaths would follow case counts in predictable patterns, experts now speak of vaccines, quote, decoupling those metrics, because they are so powerfully protective against the worst outcomes of the disease. But the shots aren't just protecting individuals. Increasing evidence shows that they take a substantial bite out of transmission once they're given to a certain swath of the population, as countries like Israel that have vaccinated most of their population have demonstrated. It's not a specific threshold. It will vary place to place depending on other factors, but experts are hoping and anticipating that some places in the U.S. could be nearing that point and drops in case counts could accelerate. One reason is that the weather got warmer, which appears to have an impact on transmission, both for behavioral reasons, people spend more time outdoors, and perhaps for biological ones. Many respiratory viruses lose some of their transmission efficiency in hotter, more humid temperatures. The B117-fueled spikes in the UK and Europe were exacerbated because they occurred over the colder months, for example. The US also had a big wall of natural immunity, blunting just how widely the virus could spread this spring. Experts estimate that more than 100 million people in the country have now recovered from an infection, the vast majority of whom remain protected against reinfection for now. And then, of course, vaccines. More than half of adults in the U.S. have received at least one dose of a vaccine, and a full third of adults are fully vaccinated. The factors that spur outbreaks or slow them, the weather, the number of susceptible people, the virus itself, the precautions people take, can compound or counteract each other. And the plateaued national case count in recent weeks is a reflection of an almost even tug of war. But it appears that the balance in more places appears to be tilting towards decline. Our optimism that the country as a whole has reached a clear turning point is further reinforced. Modelers at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's Policy Lab wrote in their latest update. This is great news for a COVID-weary nation, but we are mindful that the rates of improvement for some areas will be quicker than others. For all the progress achieved with vaccines, the U.S. is reaching the point where supply is outpacing demand in a growing number of communities. The average number of daily vaccines administered reached a peak of nearly 3.2 million early this month, but has since fallen to about 2.8 million, even as all people 16 and up become eligible for the shots. It's a matter of both access and hesitancy, and health officials at every level will increasingly have to reach people where they are or assuage their concerns to get more shots in arms. Teens and young adults could drive outbreaks if they're not incentivized to get vaccinated. Experts still foresee a summer when vacations and barbecues return. The coronavirus won't be gone from the United States, but at what level it circulates and how much damage it inflicts in large part depends on how many people in each area remain unvaccinated. Most children still won't be vaccinated this summer, but experts say that high levels of vaccine coverage among adults and lower transmission rates generally will reduce spread among children as well. One trend experts will be keeping an eye on this summer is if there are echoes of summer 2020. While the warmer weather gives states in the northern part of the country some breathing room, last summer brought large outbreaks in places like Texas and Florida, where summer temperatures drive people into air-conditioned indoors. If there are large pockets of people who remain susceptible to COVID-19 in those places, they could potentially see a repeat increase in cases, if on a significantly smaller scale, this summer. Okay, well, it's good to see some good trends nationally. But it kind of begs the question, again, of what exactly is a return to so-called normal? Meaning, when can we lift most restrictions? Well, the feds, Anthony Fauci and such, their team have said over and over that they'd really like to see less than 10,000 cases a day. We're hovering around 60,000 now, so you're talking about a 5 or 6-fold decrease. This would be something on the order of less than 100 deaths per day. We're hovering around 700. So again, another 5, 6, 7-fold decrease. And when you get down to this level, basically what it means is we're at the point at which the risk of COVID-19 is roughly comparable to the risk of the flu. The flu kills between 12 and 61,000 people over the last 10 years. And that's generally in a flu season, which is about 6 months or half the year. Of course, COVID-19 is going to vary a lot by region, and these are national numbers. And really what we're seeing is less of an inflection point than a bifurcation point, meaning we're being split into two or more. Many people are aware that we live in two Americas or three Americas or four Americas. We don't necessarily all live in the same boat, certainly not the same neighborhood or state or jurisdiction that it might be where you can have pockets of COVID-19 in this case. And of course, we're seeing these hot spots in a lot of places where there's a convergence of low vaccination rates, high levels of the variants, and the low so-called non-pharmacological interventions, basically meaning wearing masks, socially distancing. So I'm increasingly confident that as a nation, as a whole, we have turned a corner and things are generally going to get better. But I think, which is good because this whole idea of a fourth wave is I think we at least blunted that. So we're not going to see a crazy wave. That is really good news. But I do think the real question now is over the next couple months, and frankly, over the next 6 months or even a year, is at what level of vaccination will we be able to achieve and what kind of pockets of lower vaccination rates will we have? Because if you have these regions that are all over the place that don't come anywhere near herd immunity, you're potentially going to see these variants establish themselves and ravage through those communities, particularly those variants like the South African variant and the Brazilian variant, which are already present here in Lucas County, for instance, and many places around the country that can cut through the natural immunity from a previous reinfection. And that means you have to get vaccinated to get protection from that. You are not going to get protection by just having had the virus before it'll cut through a lot of that. We've seen that in other places in the world. And if we don't get high vaccination rates here, it will happen here. The question is how much and how many places. Okay, well, let's get to the local COVID-19 update. And once again, to understand where we're at, we need to understand that Michigan is still the epicenter of the COVID-19 epidemic in the United States. And this kind of puts Lucas County on the cutting edge or the front of the battle. And it looks like we have a mix of good news and bad news. We have actually seen that the Lucas County average daily number of cases has gone down to 106 a day from 138 the previous week. Ohio as a whole added 3 more counties and now has 70 of 88 Ohio counties with a high incidence. So we're still struggling to reclaim that territory. We've had good news as far as the Lucas County test positivity rate, the percentage of people who get tested who end up being positive. That dropped to 9.5% from 12.2% the week earlier, which is a good size drop. It's still kind of high, but that's nice to see that trend. Unfortunately, in Ohio, we had a little bit of reversal of fortune. The test positivity rate bumped up slightly, but is at a much lower rate at 4.5%. Nursing homes still struggling to get that down. We had 37 active cases, 15 residents and 22 staff in Lucas County, and that's similar over the last couple weeks, which is up from the month or so before that. Good news, new hospitalizations are trending down somewhat in both Lucas County and Ohio in the last week. We're still seeing the results, though, of our surge, our death rate. We had 16 deaths in the last 14 days, and that's a rate higher than both the state and national death rates. UT continues to see a low number of cases. They had 9 new infections identified in the last week in their community, and in their surveillance testing, they had a 0% positivity. Congratulations, University of Toledo. And at this point, I'd like to do a little bit of coverage on the university front. This from Medical Express. California's public universities to require COVID-19 vaccine. Two of the nation's largest university systems said they intend to require COVID-19 vaccinations for all students, faculty, and staff on University of California and California State University campuses this fall. Together, the universities employ more than 1 million students and employees across 33 major university campuses. So this is the most comprehensive and consequential university plan for COVID-19 vaccines in the country, said Chancellor Joseph Castro. Across the country, colleges are weighing how far they should go to ensure students get vaccinated. Universities like Rutgers, Brown, Cornell, and Northeastern recently told students they must get vaccinated before returning to the campus next fall. They hope to achieve herd immunity on campus, which they say would allow them to loosen spacing restrictions in classrooms and dorms. Many schools have launched vaccination blitz to get students immunized before they leave for the summer. Northeastern and other colleges requiring shots believe they're on solid legal ground. It's not unusual for colleges to require students to be vaccinated for other types of diseases, and a California court last year upheld a flu shot requirement at the University of California system. Okay, well, while the University of Toledo has done well, we have reversal of fortunes among Lucas County schools and had outbreaks in a number of school systems. We had 193 identified infections in the most recent week. That is a big jump, 15 staff and 178 students. So this is part of the trend that we're seeing that this epidemic is moving towards younger people, and that's like triple or quadruple of what we've, even more than that, over the last couple months. This might be a record for the number of students that we've identified being infected in any week. So not particularly good news on the school front. Vaccines continue to be rolled out, and the country has 42.2% of the population has had one or more dose. And the good news is that over half of those age 50 and above have had at least one dose of the vaccination. The state and the county drag by a couple percentage points lower than the U.S. as a whole. So come on, Ohio and Lucas County, get your act together. I've been tracking the racial ethnic disparity in vaccination rates among blacks and whites in Ohio. Lucas County held steady at about at 50%, meaning that blacks are half as likely to get vaccinated as whites. Ohio went up just a hair, 1% to 59% as likely for blacks to get vaccinated as whites. And since began tracking this, Ohio's gone up 5 points from 45% to 50%, and Ohio's gone up 49% to 59%. So our ability to cut through and cut back at least a little bit of this racial ethnic disparity has been half as much, half as fast in Lucas County as Ohio. So we need to up our game there. Of course, if you want to get a vaccination in Ohio, you can go to gettheshot.coronavirus.ohio.gov. You are listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life, 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Okay, well, now that vaccines are more plentiful than people who want to get them, if they keep trying to reach out and get more people vaccinated. This from The Hill. Biden calls for every employee to get paid leave for vaccinations. President Biden unveiled a program to address the issue of American workers feeling that they can't afford to take the time off to get vaccinated or lose a day of work because they aren't feeling well after a shot. I'm calling on every employer, large and small, in every state to give employees the time off they need with pay to get vaccinated, he said. And any time they need with pay to recover if they're feeling under the weather after the shot. No working American should lose a single dollar from their paycheck because they choose to fulfill their patriotic duty of getting vaccinated, the president added. Biden specifically mentioned that grocery chain Kroger is offering workers $100 to get vaccinated, which he said has pushed the vaccination rate among its associates from 50% to 75%. He announced that the IRS will soon post instructions on how employers with fewer than 500 employees can be reimbursed for the cost of providing paid leave for vaccinations. Every employee should get paid leave to get a shot. Businesses should know that they can provide it without a hit to their bottom line, he said. There's no excuse for not getting it done. Administration officials said only 43% of working adults have gotten the vaccine so far. Overall, 133 million Americans, or more than half of the adult population, have received at least one shot. So this is targeted towards workers, which are less likely to actually get vaccinated than others. Okay, well, vaccinations provide great protection from severe disease, but not complete protection from infection. This from Science Daily. Study of breakthrough cases suggests COVID testing may be here to stay. Research published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine reports results from ongoing monitoring within the Rockefeller University community, where two fully vaccinated individuals tested positive for the coronavirus. Both had received two doses of either the Moderna or the Pfizer vaccine, with a second dose occurring more than 2 weeks before the positive test. One person was initially asymptomatic and then developed typical COVID-19 symptoms. The other developed symptoms prior to testing. Both individuals recovered at home, an outcome consistent with evidence suggesting vaccination is effective in preventing severe disease. Genome sequencing revealed multiple mutations in both viral samples, including the E484K variant in one individual, first identified in South Africa and Brazil, and the S477N variant in the other individual, which has been spreading in New York since November. These patients got vaccinated, had great immune responses, and nonetheless broke through with a clinical infection, said Robert Darnell, who led the research. The observation suggests that it is likely a small but ongoing risk among vaccinated individuals and the possibility they may continue to spread the virus. The idea that we could be entirely done with testing in the post-vaccine world is probably not a good one right now. For example, even fully vaccinated people who develop respiratory symptoms should consider getting tested for COVID-19. Conversely, exposure to individuals with known infection, even if fully vaccinated, should be taken seriously, and again, individuals should consider getting tested. Given the scope of the pandemic, there's a huge amount of virus in the world right now, meaning a huge opportunity for mutations to develop and spread. That is going to be a challenge for the developers of vaccines over the next months and years. Okay, and more good vaccine news, this from The Hill. CDC recommends pregnant people get COVID-19 vaccine. The CDC director said for the first time last Friday that the agency recommends pregnant people get the COVID-19 vaccine. Director Walensky pointed out to a study published in the New England Journal of Medicine that found that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines appear to be safe in pregnant women. Importantly, no safety concerns were observed for people vaccinated in the third trimester or safety concerns for the baby, she said. As such, the CDC recommends that pregnant people receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Okay, and this from the director's blog of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins. Study finds 1 in 10 healthcare workers with mild COVID having lasting symptoms. It became increasingly clear that even healthy people with mild cases of COVID-19 can battle a constellation of symptoms that worsen over time, or which sometimes disappear only to come right back. These symptoms are part of what's called long COVID syndrome. Now, a new study of relatively young, healthy adult healthcare workers in Sweden adds needed information on the frequency of this long COVID syndrome. Published in the journal JAMA, the study found that just over 1 in 10 healthcare workers who had what at first seemed to be a relatively mild bout of COVID-19 were still coping with at least one moderate to severe symptom 8 months later. Those symptoms, most commonly including loss of smell and taste, fatigue and breathing problems, also negatively affected the work and or personal lives of these individuals. The most common symptoms in the COVID-19 group were loss of taste or smell, fatigue, and breathing problems. In this group, there was no apparent increase in other symptoms that have been associated with COVID-19, including brain fog, problems with memory or attention, heart palpitations, or muscle and joint pain. The researchers noted that the Swedish healthcare workers represent a relatively young and healthy group of working individuals. Yet, many of them continue to suffer from lasting symptoms related to mild COVID-19. It's a reminder that COVID-19 can and, in fact, is having a devastating impact on the lives and livelihoods of adults who are at low risk for developing severe and life-threatening COVID-19. If we needed one more argument for getting young people vaccinated, this is it. And in another healthcare worker story, this from The Hill. Almost one-third of healthcare workers thought about leaving jobs. Almost one-third of healthcare workers considered leaving their jobs during the coronavirus pandemic, according to a new Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation poll released last Thursday. 29% of healthcare workers said they considered no longer working in healthcare, while 71% said they never thought about changing their careers. The survey underscores the strain healthcare workers have been under since the start of the pandemic. 55% of the workers said they felt burned out. 62% said the pandemic had a negative impact on their mental health. And 47% said they either had trouble sleeping or are sleeping too much as a result of the stress. When asked about major sources of stress, 81% of healthcare workers said they were concerned about being exposed to the coronavirus at work, and 79% said they were concerned about exposing others in their households to the virus. At the time of the survey, conducted February 11th through March 7th, healthcare workers had received far more vaccinations proportionally than the general population. While only 18% of adults overall said they had received at least one vaccine dose, 52% of healthcare workers had gotten at least one shot, though 48% still had gotten at least one. Okay, well, we're also getting a firmer understanding of the long-term impact and health burden that COVID-19 is going to have. This from Science Daily. Major study details numerous long-term effects of COVID-19, pointing to massive health burden. As the COVID-19 pandemic has progressed, it has become clear that many survivors, even those who had mild cases, continue to manage a variety of health problems long after initial infection should have resolved. In what is believed to be the largest comprehensive study of long COVID-19 to date, researchers at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis showed that COVID-19 survivors, including those not sick enough to be hospitalized, have an increased risk of death in the 6 months following diagnosis with the virus. The researchers have also cataloged the numerous diseases associated with COVID-19, providing a big picture overview of the long-term complications of COVID-19 and revealing the massive burden this disease is likely to place on the world's population in the coming years. The study, involving more than 87,000 COVID-19 patients and nearly 5 million control patients in a federal database, appears in the journal Nature. Our study demonstrates that up to 6 months after a diagnosis, the risk of death following even a mild case of COVID-19 is not trivial and increases with disease severity, said senior author Zaid Alalai and assistant professor of medicine. It is not an exaggeration to say that long COVID-19, the long-term health consequences of COVID-19, is America's next big health crisis. Given that more than 30 million Americans have been infected with this virus, and given that the burden of long COVID-19 is substantial, the lingering effects of this disease will reverberate for many years and even decades. Physicians must be vigilant in evaluating people who have had COVID-19. These patients will need integrated, multidisciplinary care. In the new study, the researchers were able to calculate the potential scale of the problems, first glimpsed from anecdotal reports and smaller studies that hinted at the wide-ranging side effects of surviving COVID-19, from breathing problems and irregular heartbeats to mental health issues and hair loss. The investigators showed that after surviving the initial infection, beyond the first 30 days of illness, COVID-19 survivors had an almost 60% increased risk of death over the following 6 months compared with the general population. At the six-month mark, excess deaths among all COVID-19 survivors were estimated at 8 per 1,000 patients. Among patients who were ill enough to be hospitalized with COVID-19 and who survived beyond the first 30 days of illness, there were 29 excess deaths per 1,000 patients over the following 6 months. That would be a 3% death rate there, folks. These later deaths due to long-term complications of the infection are not necessarily recorded as deaths due to COVID-19. As far as total pandemic death toll, these numbers suggest that the deaths we're counting due to the immediate viral infection are only the tip of the iceberg. The researchers confirmed that despite being initially a respiratory virus, long COVID-19 can affect nearly every organ system in the body, including the respiratory system, the nervous system, mental health, metabolism, such as the onset of diabetes, obesity, and high cholesterol, the cardiovascular system, the gastrointestinal system, kidneys, coagulation regulation, that is blood clots, skin, including rash and hair loss, the musculoskeletal system, joint pain, muscle weakness, and general health, such as malaise, fatigue, and anemia. While no survivor suffered from all of these problems, many developed a cluster of several issues that have a significant impact on health and quality of life. Among hospitalized patients, those who had COVID-19 fared considerably worse than those who had influenza, according to the analysis. COVID-19 survivors had a 50% increase of death compared with flu survivors, with about 29 excess deaths per 1,000 patients at 6 months. Survivors of COVID-19 also had a substantially higher risk of long-term medical problems. Compared with flu, COVID-19 showed remarkably higher burden of disease, both in the magnitude of risk and the breadth of organ system involvement. Long COVID-19 is more than a typical post-viral syndrome. The size of the risk of disease and death and the extent of organ system involvement is far higher than what we see with other respiratory viruses such as influenza. Okay, well, COVID-19 is a pandemic, so let's switch our attention to worldwide. This from Medical Express. 1 billion COVID-19 vaccine doses administered globally. Woohoo! More than 1 billion doses of coronavirus vaccines have been administered worldwide, less than 5 months after the mass inoculation programs began to roll out. More than half, or 58%, have been given in three countries: the United States with 226 million doses, China with 216 million doses, and India with 138 million doses. However, in terms of the proportion of the population who have been vaccinated, Israel is in the lead, with nearly 6 out of every 10 Israelis fully inoculated. That is followed by the United Arab Emirates, with more than 51% of the population to have received at least one jab, Britain with 49%, U.S. with 42%, Chile with 41%, Bahrain with 38%, and Uruguay with 32%. In the EU, 21% of the population has received at least one dose. Worldwide, the number of vaccine doses administered has doubled in less than a month as inoculation programs pick up speed, while the majority of poor countries have also started to vaccinate, mainly thanks to the COVAX program. Inoculation is still largely a privilege of high-income countries, which are home to 16% of the world's population, but have administered 47% of the vaccine doses. Low-income countries account for just 0.2% of doses administered. And what are Americans' attitudes regarding how we should help out the rest of the world? This from Stat News. Most Americans say they should be vaccinated before the U.S. donates COVID-19 shots elsewhere. 3/4 of Americans believe the U.S. government should start donating COVID-19 vaccines to other countries, but only after every person in the U.S. who wants a vaccine has received one, according to a new survey from Stat and the Harris Poll. At the same time, just over half of Americans said they agree with the idea that the Biden administration should immediately start donating vaccines to other countries in order to achieve global herd immunity, which reflects growing concern that the coronavirus cannot be contained until most of the world is vaccinated. Meanwhile, 48% of those surveyed believe the U.S. should not donate vaccines to other countries at all and keep a stockpile instead. Many more Republicans, 58% to be exact, agree with the position, compared with 44% of Democrats. This revealed something of a dichotomy among Republicans, given that 52% of Republicans polled indicate they are hesitant to get vaccinated or do not plan to do so, but they want a pile of vaccines just in case, I guess. I find this actually very depressing that 48% of those don't want to share at all. And 44% of Democrats, that isn't very encouraging either. This is actually probably a closer. This is about as close as Democrats and Republicans get together on anything, is not wanting to share with the rest of the world. Okay, Republicans appear a little bit torn. They've expressed skepticism and hesitancy towards vaccines, but on the other hand, some acknowledge there is a value to having a stockpile. And that sentiment fits in with the idea that, first and foremost, many people are saying we should take care of the U.S. first. Well, America first lives on. I beg to disagree with that sentiment and ideology. My views are more consistent with this next article from Science Daily. Science and need, not wealth or nationality, should guide vaccine allocation and prioritization, say experts. Ensuring COVID-19 vaccine access for refugee and displaced populations and addressing health inequities is vital for an effective pandemic response. Yet, vaccine allocation and distribution has been neither equitable nor inclusive, despite that global leaders have stressed this as a critical aspect to globally overcoming the pandemic, according to a paper published by Columbia University School of Public Health. As of April 1st, high and upper middle income countries received 86% of the vaccine doses delivered worldwide, while only 0.1% of doses have been delivered to low income countries. Worldwide, over 80% of refugees and nearly all internally displaced persons are hosted by low and middle income countries, nations at the end of the line for COVID-19 vaccine doses. The COVAX facility allocates around 5% of total available vaccine doses for humanitarian use, including vaccinating refugees. Yet the total 2 billion vaccine doses targeted by the end of 2021 will only cover 20% of participating countries' populations at most. Poor countries may not be able to widely vaccinate their populations until 2023. 2 years, my friends, 2023. To create an equitable and inclusive COVID-19 vaccination strategy, the authors believe lessons can also be drawn from the experience managing conditions such as HIV and TB among mobile populations, as well as previous large-scale vaccination campaigns in humanitarian settings. They point out how the global community approaches COVID-19 vaccinations may further entrench the inequities and distrust experienced by refugees and displaced populations around the world, or is a chance to build stronger, fairer health systems that are better prepared to respond to COVID-19 and future health emergencies. Engage, listen, and mobilize trusted community and religious leaders. Involving the community, including displaced populations, in vaccine activities is vital. Policymakers need to seize the opportunity of the pandemic to strengthen health systems more broadly and sustainably, to better respond to the challenges of COVID-19, while addressing the comprehensive health needs of refugees and host populations. As the world confronts one of the most formidable public health challenges in recent history, how we respond today will not only determine the course of this pandemic, but also who benefits from public health advances for years to come. Okay, well, for anyone who thinks that we can live alone in a pandemic, this probably points out that that's not the case. This is from Reuters. United States adds 116 countries to its do not travel advisory list. The U.S. State Department has added at least 116 countries this week to its level 4 do not travel advisory list, putting the U.K., Canada, France, Israel, Mexico, Germany, and others on the list, citing a very high level of COVID-19. Last Monday, the State Department said it would boost the number of countries receiving its highest advisory rating to about 80% of countries worldwide. Before then, the State Department listed 34 out of about 200 countries as do not travel. The State Department now lists 150 countries at level 4. It declined to say when it would complete the updates. The recommendations are not mandatory and do not bar Americans from travel. Okay, well, in the changing landscape of the pandemic, here's some good news, bad news. The FDA N95 masks, now plentiful, should no longer be reused. The Biden administration has taken the first step towards ending an emergency exception that allowed hospitals to ration and reuse N95 medical masks, the first line of defense between frontline workers and the deadly coronavirus. Now, U.S. manufacturers say they have vast surpluses for sale, and hospitals say they have a 3 to 12 month stockpile or stockpiles. In response, the government says hospitals and healthcare providers should try to return to one mask per patient. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration is recommending healthcare personnel and facilities transition away from crisis capacity conservation strategies, said the agency in a letter to healthcare personnel and facilities earlier this month. The letter is not an order. Hospitals are still legally permitted to sterilize and reuse N95s, but in the coming weeks or months, the FDA will issue updated guidance and eventually require hospitals to revert to single use. The ability to decontaminate was purely a last resort, an extreme measure. From the FDA's perspective, there is a need for us to move back towards contingency and conventional strategies, which is you use the respirator for the interaction, and then you dispose of it and get a new one. We are in unison, in sync with both the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health and OSHA in that position. The National Nurses Union, the largest professional association of registered nurses in the country, calls the new guidance a tiny step in the right direction. This is the bad news. But the organization, representing 170,000 nurses, said the direction absolutely fails to protect nurses because it allows employers to use their discretion about what normal N95 supply is. But we know the reality. There is ample N95 supply, said the union in a statement, urging the administration to update their standards and enforce them. Prestige America Meritech Executive Vice President Mike Bowen, whose Fort Worth, Texas factory is the largest U.S. manufacturer of surgical masks, said the devices were designed to be used only once, not reused from one patient to the next. He said he has millions of unsold masks, as do other U.S. manufacturers, which invested and ramped up during the pandemic. While nurses pleaded for clean masks, American N95 makers were filling their warehouses with N95s that hospitals weren't buying. America's healthcare workers can and should demand clean, new N95 masks. The N95 mask shortage is over. Congressman Anna Eshoo, a Democrat from California, said the deadly shortages were a national embarrassment and should never happen again. This is welcome news and demonstrates our progress towards crushing COVID-19. We must make sure this type of shortage never happens again by reinvesting in a sustainable supply of high-quality, American-made PPE. Of course, the bad news of this is when you have voluntary things, hospitals trying to save money won't go back to the normal standard. Anything for a buck. That's U.S. healthcare. Okay, well, let's get to some better news associated with a pandemic. This from Lancet. No evidence of an increase in risk of suicide in first months of the pandemic, but continued monitoring needed. A new observational study is the first to examine suicides occurring during the early phase of the COVID-19 pandemic in multiple countries and finds that suicide numbers remain largely unchanged or declined in the pandemic's early months. The study is published in the Lancet Psychiatry Journal. The authors note that while their study provides the best available evidence on the pandemic's effects on suicide so far, it only provides a snapshot of the first few months of the pandemic, and effects on suicide might not necessarily occur immediately. The study included 21 countries and 21 countries and regions, 16 high income and 5 upper middle income, including whole country data in 10 countries and data for 25 specific areas within 11 countries. The authors found no evidence of an increase in suicide numbers in the early months of the pandemic in any of the countries included. In 12 areas, there was evidence of a decrease in suicide compared to the expected numbers. Okay, well, in similar news, another study, this from Medical Express, study finds no rise in English suicide rates during the first lockdown. Suicide rates in England did not rise following the first national lockdown in 2020, despite higher levels of greater distress, University of Manchester researchers have found. The study, published in the Lancet Regional Health Europe, provides evidence contrary to widely reported concerns that the COVID-19 pandemic may have led to an increase in suicides. The team used data from the English Real-Time Surveillance, RTS, systems in areas covering a total population of around 13 million, a quarter of the UK population. The English real-time surveillance system anonymously records suspected suicides as they occur, allowing early monitoring of figures before an inquest is held. We didn't find an increase in suicide rates in England in the months post-lockdown, although we know from surveys and calls to charities that the pandemic has made our mental health worse. Study author Nav Kapoor, professor of psychiatry and population health at the University of Manchester, said, "How can we square our finding that suicide rates have not risen despite greater reported distress? Suicide is complex, and rates do not simply follow levels of mental disorder. There may be a genuine social cohesion effect at the time of external crises. We've seen this in data from suicide rates around the world, around the time of the two world wars. Suicide rates decrease, and there's this idea that societies pull together when there's an external threat." Study author Dr. Pauline Turnbull, project director, said, "While our findings show that suicide didn't rise in England post-lockdown as many feared it might, we do need to be aware that it's too early to see some of the longer-term impacts of the pandemic, such as ongoing economic adversity. It is essential that we maintain a focus on suicide prevention." And in more pandemic-related good news, this from Health Day. Decrease seen in abusive head trauma for young children during pandemic. There was a decrease in hospital admissions for children younger than 5 years diagnosed with abusive head trauma during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a study published in Pediatrics. There's evidence that the incidence of abusive head trauma increases during and following an economic recession and following a natural disaster. For these reasons, the overall decrease in hospitalizations for abusive head trauma is indeed surprising, write the authors of an accompanying editorial. The authors conjecture that this decrease may be explained by an increased number of caregivers in the home. There may also be some under-recognition of cases. Well, that combined with the suicide data seems to really indicate that our worst fears around some of these issues have not been realized. Good news. Okay, and more pandemic-related good news from Medical Express. A plus from the pandemic, fewer kids using e-cigarettes. There appears to be a silver lining to forced school and business closures during early weeks of the pandemic, according to a new study. Fewer kids used e-cigarettes. The main reason for the decline? There was an apparent lack of access to e-cigarettes and other vaping supplies, according to researchers. Shops were closed or had limited hours, and there weren't parties or after-school hangout sessions where kids could share e-cigarettes. The opportunity for vaping was limited during the shutdown. Kids are not hanging out in the schoolyard, so there is no peer pressure to vape. So it's not all bad news. And in more good news, for what could have been really bad news, this from National Geographic. Children born to Chernobyl survivors don't carry more genetic mutations. On the morning of April 26, 1986, a reactor in a nuclear power plant in what's now northern Ukraine exploded and burned, triggering what would become history's deadliest nuclear accident. The hellish fire belched out immense clouds of radioactive fallout that entered people's lungs, settled on homes, fields, and livestock pastures, and infiltrated their supplies. Milk, salami, and eggs had become, in the words of one nuclear engineer, a radioactive byproduct. In the years since, researchers have monitored the health of populations that lived through the Chernobyl disaster, from people in nearby towns to the liquidators who cleaned up and built a huge concrete sarcophagus over the site. Nearly 35 years later, an international team has taken an extensive look at the disaster's genetic effects, and the resulting pair of studies has found reassuring new details. Allaying long-held fears over how the disaster could affect future generations, the largest study of its kind ever conducted, published in Science, finds no evidence that parents who were exposed to Chernobyl's radiation passed on any excess mutations to children conceived after exposure. Researchers hope the findings will benefit other populations affected by nuclear accidents, such as those displaced by the 2011 meltdown of Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. If there is a deleterious mutation, it's going to be rare. We can't say it's never going to happen, but we don't see this as a common public health crisis, said both studies' senior author Stephen Chenock, the director of the U.S. National Cancer Institute's Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics. We think the findings should be reassuring. While the paper cannot totally exclude that such effects could occur, it is clear from this study that risks are substantially lower than currently believed. said Robert Ulrich, the vice chairman of the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, a U.S.-Japanese cooperative based in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Ulrich was not involved with the studies. Okay, well, that kicks off the environmental news in honor of the recent Earth Day. Let's do a couple more stories here on the environment. This from UPI. More than 40% of U.S. live in cities with unhealthy air, study says. More than 40% of Americans live with unhealthy air, according to the American Lung Association's annual State of the Air report. Certain cities and certain types of Americans are far more prone to be affected. People of color are 60% more likely to live in a county shrouded in unhealthy air than are white people, and three times more likely to live in a county with failing air quality grades across the board, the Lung Association report found. Moreover, the report says climate change continues to worsen air pollution in much of the country. This report shines a spotlight on the urgent need to curb climate change, clean up air pollution, and advance environmental justice, said Harold Wimmer, president and CEO of the American Lung Association. The nation has a real opportunity to address all three at once, and to do that, we must center on health and health equity as we move away from combustion and fossil fuels to clean, renewable energy. The 2021 State of the Air report analyzes U.S. Environmental Protection Agency data from 2017 to 2019, three of the six hottest years ever recorded globally. Because of climate change, many Western states continue to experience record-breaking highs in particle pollution due to smoke from wildfires. Changing climate patterns that fuel wildfires also increase temperatures that lead to more ozone pollution. This poor air quality threatens everyone, but especially children, older adults, and people living with lung disease. Research also shows that air pollution can make COVID-19 worse. The report highlights the two most widespread outdoor air pollutants, ground-level ozone pollution and particle pollution. Both are dangerous to public health and potentially deadly. Particle pollution, or soot, comes from wildfires, wood-burning stoves, coal-fired power plants, diesel engines, and other sources. Known as PM2.5, these microscopic particles can trigger asthma attacks, heart attacks, strokes, and cause lung cancer. Research has also tied particle pollution to other serious diseases, such as asthma and dementia, and to worse COVID-19 outcomes. Due to wildfire smoke and home wood burning, nearly 54 million Americans live with dangerous spikes in short-term particle pollution, while more than 21 million live in counties with unhealthy levels of year-round particle pollution. Ozone pollution irritates the respiratory system. It can cause shortness of breath, coughing, and asthma attacks, and may shorten life. Researchers also link smog to a higher risk of conditions such as diabetes. More than 123 million Americans live in a county with a failing grade for ozone pollution, including 28 million children and 18 million people aged 65 and older. Too many people are breathing unhealthy air, and they are disproportionately likely to be people of color, Wimmer said. Join us in calling on President Biden to promote environmental justice by prioritizing historically burdened communities for pollution cleanup and to receive the benefits of investment in the transition to electric vehicles and clean, renewable electricity, he added. And in more news from Medical Express, even so-called safe ambient carbon monoxide levels may harm health, study finds. Data collected from 337 cities across 18 countries show that even slight increases in ambient carbon monoxide levels from automobiles and other sources are associated with increased mortality. The research published in The Lancet Planetary Health also found that even short-term exposure to ambient carbon monoxide at levels below the current air quality guidelines and considered safe had an association with increased mortality. The findings reveal that there is no evidence for a threshold value below which the exposure to ambient carbon monoxide can be considered, quote, safe. The study's findings strongly suggest the need to revisit global and national air quality standards for carbon monoxide, and in addition to single pollutant standards, policy should be expanded to address traffic-related air pollution mixtures. These findings have significant public health implications. Millions and millions of people live in environments with elevated carbon monoxide levels and in environments where the carbon monoxide levels are within the current guidelines considered, quote, safe range. Okay, well, in public health, we need to monitor things, to study them and control them, but not everybody always acts in good faith. This from the Colorado Sun. Colorado Air Pollution Control managers ordered staff to falsify data and approve permits at all costs, whistleblowers say. State air pollution control managers endangered the health of Coloradoans by unlawfully approving noxious gas permits for industry without federally mandated modeling or monitoring, according to a whistleblowing complaint filed by technical employees inside the agency. Three state employees claim in a complaint to the U.S. EPA Office of Inspector General that their leaders ordered them in mid-March to stop performing modeling required by the Clean Air Act. The whistleblowers from the Air Pollution Control Division, who run the computer models to predict how much pollution will result from a company's activities, say their managers bypass modeling rules in order to speed permits and avoid a paper trail should the state be sued by environmental groups. The whistleblowers say the alleged halt to modeling required by the Federal Clean Air Act is part of a years-long pattern of unlawful state actions, all of which increase health-damaging nitrogen dioxide and sulfur dioxide pollution in Colorado. Loose permitting also pushed the state deeper into non-attainment of U.S. air standards that will result in new industrial and driving sanctions, the state employees claim. The alleged policy change by Air Pollution Control Division leaders is the latest and most concrete instance of a pattern of unlawful conduct, which is directly responsible for Colorado's precipitous decline in air quality in the last decade, according to the employee complaint filed with EPA's Office of Inspector General in Washington, D.C. The complaint includes a sample list of unlawfully issued permits to Colorado industrial operations that range from asphalt plants to coal mines to oil drilling pads to meat packers to a gold mine. The complaint goes further to say that not only were they blocked from modeling in permitting a gold mine, but one of the state modeling specialists was ordered to falsify data to avoid the model predicting a violation. The complaint describes in detail a leadership culture of approving permits at all costs in its overarching agency, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. Employees say the division enforces certain standards only when an individual permit might draw extra public attention. Public scrutiny is the only criteria that the agency is concerned about when enforcing or abstaining from the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, not legal obligations or concerns for public health and the environment, the complaint reads. Worsening air quality is a long-time problem. The noxious emissions the whistleblowing employees claim are being illegally ignored contribute to high concentrations of ozone along the Front Range, which spikes to dangerous levels for human health on hot Colorado days. The Denver metro area has been under heightened EPA scrutiny for ozone for decades, and the state was notified that it faces demotion to an even lower attainment category in 2022 that will force state regulators to clamp down harder on stationary sources such as oil drilling or asphalt plants and mobile emissions from vehicles. The U.S. Clean Air Act requires each state to have a state implementation plan to control six criteria pollutants considered especially dangerous when inhaled, ranging from carbon monoxide and lead to nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, ozone, and particulates. Particulates can form from combinations of substances and are measured in microns at standards of 2.5 or 10. When an industrial user applies for an air quality permit, the EPA requires states to model or monitor the proposed emissions of each substance in either short-term averages or annual averages. Permitting staff and their supervisors are meant to draw on the expertise of the modelers when they decide to approve, alter, or deny an application to emit pollution. The complaint also doubles down on ongoing tensions between industry, regulators, and environmental advocates who want more real-time independent monitoring of actual emissions rather than computer modeling or aggregated annual reporting. The state duty to determine the actual status of air quality, the complaint concludes, has been neglected for years. Environmental advocates and local legislators are pushing for increased real-time state-mandated monitoring of air pollution sources at multiple locations this year. A bill passed a House committee last week that imposes real-time monitoring with data disclosed to the public for four high-pollution industrial locations on the Front Range. Well, good luck with that, Colorado. Okay, well, I'd like to close out stories today with some good news in a completely unrelated field. This from Medical Express. Music improves older adults' sleep quality. I'm personally fond of this one since I often listen to music before I go to bed. Listening to music before going to bed can improve sleep quality among older adults according to an analysis of all relevant published clinical trials. In the analysis, which is published in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, 5 randomized trials met the investigator's criteria. Older adults who listened to music experienced significantly better sleep quality than those who did not listen to music. Also, older adults who listened to sedative music experienced a greater improvement in sleep quality than those who listened to more rhythmic music. Furthermore, listening to music for longer than 4 weeks was especially effective at improving sleep quality. Music intervention is an effective strategy and is easy to administer by the caregiver or healthcare worker, the authors wrote. Music therapy might be the first line of therapy to recommend in older adults with sleep disturbances, which could reduce the need for dependence on sedatives and sleeping medication. Woohoo! Music, the universal language. No surprise, it's good for us. Okay, well, I'll close the show with some bonus articles that can be found online. I'll give the link after I cite them. Number one, the fast lane for COVID testing has opened up in the U.S. States have a new COVID problem, too much vaccine. 3, we are turning COVID-19 into a young person's disease. 4, low tech but high value, don't stop reimbursing phone-only telehealth visits. And lastly but not least, 5, in Q&A, Vice President Harris calls for urgent action on the black maternal health crisis. I've reported a lot on that, but if you want to hear Kamala Harris's take on that, go online at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. And I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.